You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the U.S. is the only developed country that doesn't guarantee paid family leave. Our guest walks us through the lessons she says our country can learn from the rest of the world about what works best when it comes to family leave policy. First, it's been 10 years since food writer Michael Pollan published The Omnivore's Dilemma. The book had a huge influence and sparked a national discussion and debate about where our food comes from, how it's produced, and what the ethical implications are of the choices that we make as consumers in all senses of that word. Michael Pollan joins us now to look at the landscape of American food 10 years after The Omnivore's Dilemma was first published. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, it's been 10 years since you first published The Omnivore's Dilemma. Looking back, do you remember what you saw and felt then about the way we ate that prompted you to write this book?
I do, actually. I wrote this book because I'd gotten curious about what is seems like a very dumb and obvious question, which is, where does our food come from? And I'd realized I didn't know. And that the food looked the same in the supermarket. You know, a steak looked like a steak and an ear of corn looked like an ear of corn. But the way we were producing those, I was getting clues, had been revolutionized in the last 50 years. And it was a change that very few Americans knew about, unless you were actually in the farm belt. And so we had urbanized our livestock. They were all now on feedlots and no longer outside on grass. And we had figured out ways to grow giant monocultures of corn and soy, which became the basis of the whole food system. And we'd industrialized things and automated things in ways that nobody knew. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to write a book of detective stories about where our food comes from? And that's what I ended up doing. And I looked at the horrible and the wonderful and along the way, because we are fed by several different food systems. I mean, we're not all fed by the same, you know, there's an organic food chain, there's a local food chain, and there's an industrial food chain. And then there's the little food chain if you have a garden or raise your own chickens, the shortest food chain of all. So I went following each of those food chains back to the source to figure out what was happening down on the farm and how that had changed. And for me, it was incredibly eye-opening. I had many epiphanies, and it ultimately changed the way I eat. In dramatic ways. And as I'm gratified to see, it changed the way a lot of my readers ate as well.
So it changed the way you ate. You had enough epiphanies along the way that even, you know, a professor of journalism would realize there were these areas of his life that needed changing. Pretty dramatic.
Well, you know, we're all kind of disconnected. I mean, we live in this highly specialized economy where we only need to know one or two things to survive. You know how to do your job. I know how to do my job. And then we let other people take care of almost everything else for us. And gradually we lose track of how they're doing it. And that's certainly true for food. 75 years ago, everybody knew farmers or was a farmer or spent time on farms and understood how the food was produced, but we've outsourced it to this very complex system. And so, yeah, we lost track. I mean, even someone who tries to stay abreast of things, as I do, there was so much I didn't know and so much that shocked me. I mean, I described in the new afterword going to the farm where the French fries come from, one of them in the Magic Valley of Idaho, and being stunned that how automated this farm was. But one of the reasons it was so automated is that the farmers were using chemicals that they had to stay away from for 3 or 4 days after they sprayed them. They were so toxic. So they farmed from indoors, manipulating the water and fertilizer and pesticide automatically on computers. And then after they harvest these potatoes, they couldn't sell them right away because they were so infused with pesticides that they had to rest them for 6 weeks in this giant atmosphere-controlled shed. It was like the size of a basketball arena, while the potatoes off-gassed all the chemicals in them. I had no idea we had to do that, and that a potato dug from the field was too toxic to eat immediately. So all this was news to me, and there is this quality of, you know, oh my God, listen to this, or look at this, or, you know, let me take you here in the book. But I also was thrilled to find that there were really exciting alternatives to this chemically based and oil-based system. Farmers doing really exciting work, with long rotations, putting animals together in interesting combinations that led to happy animals and beautifully produced meat, and so that we weren't stuck with this one system. That there was another system. It was very small, it's true, but you could vote with your fork for another kind of agriculture, and indeed people have been voting with their fork over the last 10 years, and the alternatives to the industrial system have really flowered and flourished.
You're right. It has been 10 years since Omnivore's Dilemma, and since your book helped to spark a revolution in the way that we think about food, what do you see as the biggest changes in those past 10 years?
Well, I would say two things. I mean, one is that the average consumer is curious now about the origin of their food and how it was produced. You see, and the food industry knows this. The food industry feels itself, I talk to these executives all the time, they feel themselves under enormous pressure to be more transparent and to remove chemicals from the food and to get meat that's been raised in a more sustainable way. They're not all succeeding in doing it. Most of them are actually trying. And that is because the consumer has moved. It is a very, oddly enough, responsive industry because these executives know that food scares and food fads come and go very quickly and can completely disrupt an industry. So they are, they know they need to change, and many of them are trying to, and they're making good faith efforts to change. And that's very exciting. But I really see that as something that's been driven strictly by the consumer. The government's done very little to change things over the last 10 years, shamefully little in many cases. So I'm encouraged by that. I'm encouraged by that we have a more conscious consumer, because that really has been my goal as a writer. I don't prescribe particular systems or particular ways of eating, but I do encourage people to simply be conscious, on the theory that if we're more aware, we will make better choices. And I think that that's been held out.
And there's some new terminology that exists now that didn't used to exist 10 years ago. One of these is food movement. Another you talk about is celebrity farmer. That's something that you didn't really see 10 years ago. Can you talk about some of those changes in the way we see things?
Yeah, one of the really interesting developments in the last 10 years, and again, I don't want to take credit for this because there were other people and chefs in particular who had a lot to do with this, is the rising prestige of the farmer in our culture. I mean, this is a culture that where farmers were the butts of jokes, of dumb jokes, for years and years and years. And now you see that it's considered a pretty cool way to make a living, a difficult way to make a living. And you have lots of young people who want to go into farming. A couple years ago, the most popular internship in America was working on an organic farm. And I think that's a really healthy thing. All those people won't become farmers, but they're going to understand farming and therefore support farmers in a very different way. And the farmer you're referring, the celebrity farmer, was one that I profiled at great length in the book, and that's Joel Salatin. And his farm I spent a week on working and visited several times. Polyface Farm is one of the most beautiful and sustainable farms in America. And Joel, since the book has come out, has become an international celebrity. He's speaking not just to farmer groups but to consumer groups all over the world now. And his model of farming, which is breathtaking in its ingenuity. He raises six or seven different animal species in a very elaborate rotation so that, each of them serves the other in some way, is being imitated all over. And there you have these, they're called permaculture farms. They need very few inputs. They kind of provide for their own fertility and insect control without chemicals, and this kind of farming is spreading, and that's very exciting to see. So, if I've contributed in any small way to the change in the status of the farmer, I think that's wonderful, because we're going to need a lot more farmers to grow food sustainably. I mean, one of the reasons we go down this industrial path with lots of chemicals and lots of machinery is because we don't have enough people on the land. And the only way you can do a 50,000-acre potato field is, or 10,000-acre potato field, is with lots of technology. Technology is a replacement for human labor, basically. And we've thought it was a virtue to empty the farms of people. But I think we're learning that was a mistake. It's really hurt our rural areas. And that to really have scrupulous, environmentally sustainable farming, we're going to need more farmers.
Now, one thing you talk about in terms of what's still to come, what's still ahead, is maybe it's time for the creation of a national food policy. Can you tell us a little bit about what that might look like?
Yeah, you know, in thinking about how to reform this system, I've really been struck by the fact that, you know, we have a national economic policy and we have national environmental policies, but we don't have a national food policy. And food is so important, both to the public health and to the health of the environment, that you would think we would. We have agricultural policies, but those are kind of special interest policies designed to prop up farmers. And that's how we get into the situation we're in, where these agricultural policies, which essentially encourage the government to heavily subsidize industrial agriculture and corn and soybean production in particular, that these policies actually work at cross purposes with by undermining the public health. Because if you have a food system that's based on corn, you're going to have a lot of high fructose corn syrup. And so you have this crazy situation where the government is actually encouraging the production of high fructose corn syrup. At the same time, it's paying to treat all this type 2 diabetes that's exploding and is the result of eating too much high fructose corn syrup. So we need a national food policy that will force our agricultural policies to support both our health objectives and our environmental objectives. And so that's what I've been pushing for. I think if there were a national, you know, food policy forum in the White House or a food czar who was riding herd over other parts of the government to encourage farmers to grow the healthiest possible food and to make healthy food available to everybody as one of the primary goals of agricultural policy. It's not right now. That would be a great thing.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was food writer Michael Pollan. He joined us to talk about what's happened in the world of food politics in the 10 years since he first published The Omnivore's Dilemma. Coming up after the news, our guest says family leave in the United States is looking more and more inevitable. She walks us through what she says a modern American family leave policy should look like. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off this week. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.